Welcome. You are about to take a journey to a place of the divine love within with Deborah Buffet on the Love by Intuition show. For the next hour, allow her to prepare you in becoming a magnet for a profound love-infused relationship by identifying and focusing on solutions through love. Awaken the light within and let your essence shine. And now, here's Deborah Buffet on Love by Intuition, all part of the Dream Vision 7 radio network.
Welcome, everyone. Bonjour, mes amis. And yes, here I am, Deborah Beauvais, founder and owner of the Dream Vision 7 radio network, the Kids for Love Project, and everything that encompasses Dream Vision 7. If you're tuning in for the first time, we are a Boston-based internet radio station. We're fully producing live shows, videos, everything that you can imagine, just like a regular radio station. We have talk radio Monday through Saturday and Divine Music on Sunday. So check us out when you get a chance. And stay tuned to hear all the shows all during the week. Well, I have special guests this evening, and it's going to be quite a show. Please share it with other people. I don't know if everyone's aware, but May is Brain Tumor Awareness Month, and then coming Friday, DIPG Awareness Day is May 17th. And you're probably familiar with Wendy Fashion if you're listening to the shows. She has the Story Walking Radio Hour. That's Mondays, 9 a.m. and 9 p.m. weekly. And so I have invited both Dean Fashion and Wendy, and they are going to share their journey of what happened with their son, Neil, both from a personal perspective, all that they did, and then what happened with his treatment or non-treatment. A little bit about this, because Dean has actually written a book. There are going to be three, a trilogy, and it's DIPG, Eternal Hope versus Terminal Corruption. Coming in June, okay, number one, and then it's covering the time from misdiagnoses to diagnosis and from choosing and commencing treatment to being denied treatment through a long series of moves and countermoves. Neil, Dean's son, was caught in the middle of a life and death chess game. So we are going to be covering a lot of information. And without further ado, welcome to the show both Dean and his wife, Wendy.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you for coming on. I mean, I am so honored to have this opportunity to be with you both. And at the same time, what information you are going to share is going to change the lives of a listener, a family, a child, an aunt, whoever is involved in the process of DIPG. It's going to help, because, you know, it's going to be out in the ethers, in the energy field. So it's going to be felt, and I feel that is very important. So let's get started with Dean. Why don't you tell us what kind of person was Neil?
That's a difficult question to answer in a few words. He was energetic, sympathetic, compassionate, athletic, caring. One of my favorite people on the whole planet. And losing him certainly was a great loss for us personally, but it was a loss for a lot of his friends and the rest of his family, and for whatever he would have done in the future, which would have been good stuff.
Absolutely. Wendy, can you add to that as the mom?
Oh, gosh. He was kind of remarkable. It was remarkable to be his mom and his dad. I mean, he was just such a wonderful kid, and it's so tragic what happened to him. And I know we wish he was still here today, but what we can do is share his story, and that's the important thing.
Sharing his story in the hopes that something that we might be able to share helps someone else avoid similar pitfalls. And there's a lot of nasty things happening to a lot of people these days.
Right. Yeah, so let's start with, it all began 19 when he had a few concussions. Dean, you want to take it from there?
Well, he reported to have had hits to his head. He was never knocked out. It's debatable whether he actually really had concussions, but he went to the university health clinic to get assessed, and was basically told that's probably what it was, don't worry about it, sort of thing. And so he breathed a sigh of relief, phew, okay. And then he did something similar again, and it was, you know, sort of developing a little bit of symptom. It was, you know, potentially concussion-related. And so, again, it was sort of like concussions, treatment for concussions, and, you know, report if anything gets worse. And this proceeded through three rounds, and each time, right from the first, when we learned about it, we said, get an MRI. I mean, that's the only way you're going to find out for sure what's going on. And the pushback that he got from the doctors he spoke with is, you don't need an MRI. They don't tell you anything about concussions. And so he's sort of like, okay, that's it. You don't need the MRI. And that dragged on for 5 months before, after escalating symptoms, post a third concussion report. He was finally referred to a neurologist who didn't like his assessment at all, and finally had the MRI done and discovered he's got a DIPG tumor, which the DIPG tumors is one of the rarest of all tumors, only 300 or so cases a year in the United States, and most of them are in very young children. Neil was an old man, effectively, as regards getting a DIPG tumor.
And why did you ever receive any clarification as to why a 19-year-old would end up with that kind of a tumor? Or is it just because of epigenetics and different things of that sort that all these rare things are coming about?
Oh, well, we never got a solid explanation. You know, it's sort of like it's either genetics or it's environmental, but wouldn't pin it on either one necessarily. Mm-hmm. If I had to pin it on something, I mean, there was an episode that occurred before he went to college that upset me tremendously at the time, and something that I felt in my heart was something bad happened. He had to check up with his GP, required for college, just, you know, clear health records, whatever. And while he was at the checkup, which he asked to go to on his own, drive the car himself, and heck, why not? I mean, he's going to be more and more independent, so go for it. And he came back and said, I got a couple of vaccines while I was there. And one was for meningitis, and the other one was for HPV.
Gardasil.
The Gardasil, whatever.
Right.
As soon as he said that, I just felt a dread pass through me. It was very visceral. And, you know, to this day, I'm pretty sure that that's what kicked it off. You know, 18 months later, he's got a brain tumor, and an otherwise healthy, you know, athletic, everything going for him kid. I mean, that's just about enough time for something to incubate and act up. And that's what I'll always think.
Yes, and you said in the book, you've actually said, well, one of them is for the brain, and the other one is for cancer.
Right.
And but isn't that mostly focused on the girls and not the boys? And yet I've heard boys actually having the vaccine.
They've been pushing the vaccine on boys for a few years at least, as well as girls. The more the merrier, their attitude seems to be. But yeah, no, in Rhode Island there was a program called Vaccinate to Graduate. I don't know if it's still in effect, but I think Neil might have gotten caught up in that. He was graduated already, but the round had this policy of, you know, you have to have all the vaccinations on the, what do you call, the table of vaccines that are required to graduate. So that might have been the impetus behind then giving him the shot. I don't know. I was so upset with it, though. I did communicate with my doctor. And no one's was very displeased by that.
Right. So tell us more about the DIPG. What did you find out about that? And then we can go from there, because I had read also that it can be gene mutations involved.
Well, gene expressions definitely play a huge role in all cancers, and how genes express themselves or don't express themselves. You can have genes that are healthy genes that aren't turned on, and by virtue of not being turned on, cancer can develop. And you can have cancer genes that can get flipped off and help cancer to dissipate. DIPG, you know, maybe they don't know for sure. I mean, there's a half a dozen genes that have been identified as being very common across all the tissue samples that they've taken over time. But there's dozens and dozens, if not hundreds, of others that are involved and that'll flip on and flip off at intervals throughout the course of the disease. It's a disease in the brainstem, the diffuse intrinsic pontine, the pons,
yep.
Glioma. It's basically the sheaths that surround the nerve cells that the glial cells, I guess.
The
protective tissue, ironically, which develops the cancer, which starts to pull the synapse apart, and effectively, you know, over time, you're being decapitated.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no surgical option. It's diffuse, as in it's intermixed with healthy cells at the cellular level. There's no separating cells, apart sort of thing.
Right. So in essence, they give you, like going to MGH, Mass General, or Dana-Farber, or any of the known places in Boston that would know DIPG, because as you said, it's rare. There's only 300 cases per year. So there isn't enough attention and enough information and enough research in that particular area. So, but you found, let's talk about once he was diagnosed and they gave him 3 months or 6 months if he did radiation. Is that correct?
That's correct. It was sort of sitting there. And so what do we do about it? Well, you know, you'll be 3 months if you don't do anything and 6 months if you do radiation and
be sick.
Some other possibilities that were outlined that were somewhat experimental but still mainstream enough. There was taking a biopsy of the tissue to try and type it as best they can to a chemo that might be effective in fighting it. It was a stereotactic biopsy procedure, they called it. Drilling a hole in the head and taking a little sample, and that had with it certain, you know, potential side effects that, you know, Neil was like, gee whiz, you know, I'd like to beat this thing if it's at all possible, and I don't necessarily want to be limping the rest of my life because I had a, you know, brain injury from a biopsy. So that wasn't real attractive to him. He didn't want to do radiation very much from the start, certainly not with the prospect of only getting 3 months extension on what was basically a death sentence. So we were right from the get-go trying to say, okay, there's got to be something better. There's got to be something more than this.
Right. And I want to commend both of you, because what you hit the ground running as soon as you found out, and both of you were doing research. Evie, your daughter, was helping out doing research, getting, you know, CDs of brain scans and all kinds of different things through this process. You really, both of you, became experts almost in all the different procedures, what the pros and cons were. Wendy, you went to town with Gerson nutrition and changed Neil's diet and all the, you know, the pans, the glassware, everything you did. I thought to myself, how fortunate he is to have parents like you, where you just, you did everything that you could possibly, you did everything. And so let me talk to Wendy for a little bit about the Gerson diet. That, I mean, it is a fact. It's not something that we're just talking about, but nutrition, that's how the body thrives. That's how the foods and supplements and herbs can actually help cells heal, replace, kill off cancer cells. It's all, it all works. And then I was happy to read that you went to see Dr. Noe. She's excellent. But Wendy, talk about the nutrition side and how extensive that was.
Well, I read a number of books really fast. friend of ours was a doctor, gave us some books to read. Gerson was in there, Brzezinski was in there, other doctors, Gonzalez. So absorbing all that information, Dean had already knew something about the Gerson therapy. So we looked really hard at that. And then a book I had read that I really loved, it was called Anti-Cancer. And it talked about how certain foods, like kale, you know, stuff that we eat every day, blueberries, and I go on and on, actually can turn genes on and off, help with the expression of genes. So food can help in that way. Food can help detox the body. We also did some herbal teas, met with an herbalist, Mary Blue, and teas can support the immune system, the circulatory system, other system, lymphatic system. There's different herbs that can play different roles in helping improve your immunity to help you fight the disease. Not necessarily cure the disease, but to improve your chances, right? So a lot of that. And then Dr. Noe, who you mentioned, she's a naturopathic oncologist, and she gave us a lot of tips on diet, like how much protein meal needed a day, recommending particular foods, bone broth being one of her favorites. And even, you know, we even talked about medical marijuana. So there was a lot of information we're sorting through.
Well, one of the big things about Gerson also was, you know, cut out all processed foods.
Yes.
Sugars. And going into juicing of fresh organic vegetables, started doing that quite a bit. I mean, there were a lot of elements to that whole episode and his saga that it's tough to cover even in a short time at all. But I wanted to mention that.
Yeah.
The
right.
Processed foods and sugars, just
yeah.
Cut them out all completely. Neil was bound up severely when we brought him home from college, and it took 2 weeks to get his GI tract running properly.
Yeah, coffee enema is part of the Gerson therapy. So we learned how to do that.
You know, you can't say enough about nutrition, especially organic. And we know, you know, it's a fact that there's 80,000 chemicals allowed in this country. And they always say, you know, well, a little bit won't harm you. But if you've got 45 different things going in, that a little bit, it all adds up. It just doesn't make sense, that statement. But nonetheless, I know, I mean, it's, you know, okay, so 20 years later, what do you have? And then you have all these different, you know, diseases that weren't there before. And it's not rocket science. It's just not rocket science. But I really love that you did so much work in that area, Wendy, because it did make a difference. And his body was thriving in that respect. And, so let's move into, because this Well, we only have a couple more minutes. So in that couple minutes before our first break, let me say this is a live show. People can call in. Bob is in the house and happy to take your call. The number is 833-220-1200. When we come back, I want to get into all the things that you decided, even the Kentucky trials. And then let me just ask you that before break. I always thought, and forgive me if I don't know, but I thought a trial was where X amount of people got the real treatment and the others got a sugar solution. Is that still true? Or were some of these... Go ahead.
It depends what phase. There's phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials. Phase three clinical trials are the ones that do the double-blind approach.
Okay.
Phase two, the trial Neil ended up in, the phase two trial of Brzezinski, was getting the real medication. The phase one trial in Kentucky was there just getting their feet wet, just starting to figure out what doses of the things that they want to try would be safe and
not have side effects, or
et cetera, et cetera.
Finding what the side effects might be.
So it's a staged process, and it's not until the phase three that you have the double blind placebo versus some of the real versus not.
Okay. So even at Brzezinski's clinic, if Neil was able to have that third session, would it be a question of whether he got the real treatment or not?
Well, it wasn't a phase three trial. I mean, it's not like sessions. It's not like one patient goes through a phase one and then a phase two and a phase three. It's like a phase one trial might last 2 or 3 or 4 years, and then they'll come up with their results, and based on that, they'll create a criteria for a phase two trial. A phase two trial, whole different cohort of patients, and it might last 3, 4, 5, 10 years. Who knows? But again, it's bounded, and they come to an end, and they make their conclusions, and they say this thing rarely worked, so let's go phase three, and that'll be a whole new cohort. And again, it's over an extended period of time, so it wasn't like Neil missed out or could have been in a phase three and not gotten the real medication. He was in a phase two, and he was getting the real anti-neoplastons.
Okay, I want to ask more about that too. But let's take our break. Everyone stay with us. Don't go away. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Experience a different yet profound healing with Reconnective Healing. Includes yet expands beyond any and all known forms of energy healing. The Reconnective Healing Spectrum is comprised of the full healing and evolutionary continuum of energy, light, and information. It allows for healings that are not just physical, not just mental, not just emotional, yet go beyond that to bring healing that includes the evolution of your very being and essence. Deborah Beauvais, trained and certified by world-renowned Dr. Eric Pearl, offers appointment hours at Seekonk Family Chiropractic in Seekonk, Massachusetts. For questions or to set up both distance or local sessions, call Deborah at 508-431-1959. Again, 508-431-1959. Or go to lovebyintuition.com. That's lovebyintuition.com.
Calling all authors. Have you been considering an audiobook? Well, look no further. Come take advantage of DreamVision 7 Radio Network's unique in-house audiobook production, which includes benefits and bonuses from our radio station. Let our knowledgeable staff guide you to create the audiobook you've always dreamed of without breaking the bank. Check out our full one-stop service from A to Z, including the ACX process. Schedule a free consultation by calling 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or go to DreamVision7Radio.com.
After narrowly surviving the attack on Sandy Hook Elementary, first grade teacher Caitlin Roy DeBellis was left searching for answers that would never come. Eventually, she chose to focus on questions that could be answered. How do I make sure this tragedy doesn't define us? How do we get our control back? Those two questions led her to found the 501c3 nonprofit organization Classes for Classes. When gifts poured into their classroom, she decided they would help someone else by paying it forward and being kind. This developed into a social network which allows K-8 classrooms to connect so that every student in the United States can learn these crucial lessons. Classes for Classes' mission is to build students' social-emotional intelligence by connecting them to care. All C4C projects are crowdfunded. Any teacher in the U.S. can visit classesforclasses.org. That's classes, the number 4, classes.org. Sign up today.
Delight your kids with an enchanting journey by reading the Paper Doll Kids children's book by Deborah Beauvais and Janine Sullivan. There's even a catchy tune, Kids for Love Song, produced by Bob Sherwood and sung by kids just like yours. The story weaves around 7 paper dolls flying around the world doing good deeds as they bring important attention to our endangered animal friends. There's even a magical ring with a universal message. Kids become interested in service projects, action through compassion, and planting seeds that nurture positive change. The Paper Doll Kids and Kids for Love Song are a production of the Kids for Love Project. Get the book now on Amazon Kindle and the song on CD Baby or iTunes.
High school student Neil Fashan dreamed of leading other young people away from hopelessness to helpfulness, from loneliness to friendship, and from inertia to difference making. Then, in college, he was diagnosed with terminal brain cancer. After Neil died at age 20, his mother, Wendy, began to sort through the memorabilia he'd accumulated over the years. Artwork, notebooks, journals, personal notes, and letters. She's assembled these memories into a timely ebook called The Difference Maker. Parents and teens will appreciate this collection of stories about kindness, resilience, faith, and love. Go to thestorywalking.com website, download The Difference Maker, and become inspired.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
And we are back, and we are with Dean and Wendy Fashan, and they are sharing their journey on everything that they could possibly do to save their son, Neil, and then the medical journey as well and what they've learned. And we've got more to share with you, the listener, with the hopes to help someone else that may have a child in that situation. And really, cancer itself with kids, because any kind of information would help a family start somewhere, if that makes sense. Dean has actually written a book, DIPG, D as in dog, I as in ice, P as in play, G as in go, Eternal Hope versus Terminal Corruption. That is the book. If you want to go on the site, it's dipgbook.com, simple as it is, dipgbook.com. Wendy has written a book. It's an e-book right now, and you heard in the commercial, go on her site, The Story Walking Hour, and you will be able to download that. And then just pass the show along, because something will be a gem of info for another out there, whether it's now or a year from now. Pass it on. So back to the show. And Dean, I wanted to ask you a little more about the different things, a couple other things that were going on, and then between you and Wendy and Neil, of course, Neil decided to go to the Brzezinski Clinic. And tell us a little bit about the controversy over that. Some of the doctors at MGH and Dana-Farber were more kind than others, and then it's all manifested, really. So if you could talk about that.
Well, after we went to MGH and kind of got the baseline of what they could offer, and again, first approach was radiation, and the second approach was doing the biopsy and tissue sampling, and that's pretty leading edge as far as mainstream medicine is concerned. Unfortunately, the prognosis going that route to the point at which Neil was diagnosed, at least, had not yielded any results that were any more beneficial than just doing the radiation. So, you know, when we left Mass General that first day, I was like, well, we're just going to have to find something better. And, you know, Wendy mentioned several books that we have that are good resources, and she can, you know, tell you some of those titles. There were also some very good video documentaries available that go through some alternative cancer treatments that your doctor just won't tell you about. The Truth About Cancer being one of them by Ty and Charlene Bollinger. And then I happen to know about Brzezinski because my mother had been diagnosed with cancer quite a few years before all this happened with Neil, and trying to find therapies for her, I discovered Brzezinski and watched a documentary about him, and it was all quite informative, and a lot of it based on trial court testimony and whatnot, to the effect that, you know, Brzezinski has a very promising treatment regimen, but is not being widely accepted by mainstream medicine, and you got to scratch your head and wonder as to why. And, you know, and it really comes back to who's raking in the big bucks, who's in control, and stuff like that. You know, there were several clinical trials that were conducted using Brzezinski's medications, but they were conducted in such a fashion as to water down so that the results were not stand out, and they suppressed him in that regard. And then they tried to run him out of business a few times with various investigations and raiding his offices and what. It's a long and convoluted story. Bottom line is that he persevered throughout, and amongst all the possibilities that we looked for, and one trial in Kentucky was very interesting. As you mentioned previously, it was an immunotherapy trial, which at that time and even still today, there's kind of a buzz to the whole concept of immunotherapy, about stimulating your immune system to recognize the cancer and fight it off on its own. And we hung on to that possibility for as long as possible, nurturing the potential for Neil's participation. One of the gating factors to that was they required radiation. It was part of their protocol.
Yeah, why is it, do you think, either you or Wendy, or both, why is it that this radiation is attached to everything? And I thought that, I guess you have to follow the rules, because if you do not want to have radiation, that's your choice. But it's almost, if you want to be involved with the potential of a healing treatment, you have to do the radiation, which doesn't make sense, because that burns and destroys the immune system that the immunology is actually, why kill it and then try to fix it after?
Yeah, no, that certainly seemed to be a stumbling block, you know, in terms of logical reasoning to us. Everything pretty much except for the Brzezinski trial required radiation, suggested radiation, pushed radiation. And again, with only 3 months to be gained and side effects to be had at the same time, that might take them, you know, a few weeks to recover from. The extra few months might not really, you know, be that meaningful. One of the big attractions of the Brzezinski trial was that they had a cohort that did not want to take radiation, did not take standard therapy. But, you know, right. The radiation always, you know, suggested, you know, one of our doctors said, well, it's because we have had the best results with that. And you know, barring something else that supersedes it, radiation at least offers some benefit. You know, one of the things that we discovered, and my daughter discovered actually in researching Brzezinski, was a patient who had been treated at his clinic for DIPG, and it was like 2.5 or 3 years later after her treatment, she was fully recovered and living in Argentina. Her name was Celeste Sabah, and Neil was like, his eyes popped out of his head when he learned about that, and can I talk to her? And Evie said, absolutely. She expressed an interest, and so she got back in touch with Celeste and set up a date, And the three of them, you know, Skyped for 45 minutes or so, and Neil got a chance to talk to someone who was treated at the Brzezinski Clinic, not, you know, I mean, directly from the horse's mouth. This is firsthand from a woman who
DIPG.
Been treated for DIPG, had gone the gamut of radiation and chemotherapy with her traditional medicine practitioners, and had even been at one point referred to MD Anderson, ironically also in Houston. MD Anderson is a very renowned cancer clinic, and they basically took a look at her records and gave her an exam and sent her home, said there was nothing more that they could do for her. And it was after that, they got home, that her father, who just wasn't really happy about accepting no as an answer, kept on looking and discovered the Brzezinski Clinic and found more information and then said, okay, we're going back to Houston. And so Neil got this whole saga of Celeste and culminating, and she was perfectly well, and she's still well to this day and is married and has a child and maybe a second one. And this was a woman who had DIPG. And there were others. There were a small handful of other DIPG survivors that we became aware of, one of which Neil spoke with also while we were down in Houston after all the kerfuffle with the FDA was resolved.
Right. So let's get into that a bit with he chose, you all went down there, and I can't imagine all the paperwork that you've had to do over that span of time. Then they need this, then they need that, everywhere, any kind of a health system. But he chose, and you went down there, and he was excited, and he finally was able to start a treatment session, and he had to have surgery because they had to put the tube up his groin. That's how they were getting it in there. So he went through quite a bit just to have treatment. So tell us about that and what happened. And you were at the store, Wendy, buying proper pans and all this. I mean, I could just see you doing everything that was ever needed to be done. You did it.
Well, the surgery that he had was actually subclavian. It was inserted under sort of near his collarbone and up into an artery or a vein.
Yeah.
Vein, mm-hmm. A vein, I'm pretty sure.
Took all the half hour.
It was, but, you know, prior to that, I mean, the clinical trial that he did end up selecting amongst three that were in the hopper, the two most interesting, the immunotherapy and the Brzezinski trial. These are both FDA approved and independent review board approved trials. The Brzezinski was listed on the clinicaltrials.gov website. That was kind of a surprise, actually, to discover that, but that was the case. And at any rate, once the selection process was over, and I was like bouncing back and forth between three or four possibilities, constantly in the air, juggling, communicating from one hospital to another, and records being bounced around back and forth from one hospital to another because everybody needed to see the imaging and stuff like that, until you know, finally settled on going to Brzezinski, and again it was FDA approved, and the paperwork that Neil had to review was given ample time to go through, and he asked questions of Brzezinski about side effects and all the questions that he could think of, and ultimately said, yeah, I want to go for this, and signed the papers. Brzezinski signed the papers and, you know, started the whole regimen of tests that were required by the protocol to indeed make it into the phase of being administered the medication. That wasn't certain until he passed all the procedural tests and had the subclavian catheter installed and commenced treatment. And on the very first day of treatment, as we're starting to learn of all the procedure to get to get this medication into him, which is something that we were being trained on how to do because we'd take it over when we planned to go home. The trial itself was to last 2 years, not something that was going to fix him overnight. It was a long, slow, gentle process. And, you know, the very first day after he was plugged in for about 5 minutes on the infusion or so, how do you feel? And he just sort of, looked thoughtfully for a moment. He said, it feels like there's a waterfall on the back of my head. Mm. And a very, you know, kind of a smiling, like something's going on, it feels good sort of a way. That was, you know, he was, I guess, about a half a dozen or eight infusions, days of infusions. We had one day when they were upping the dose constantly, and they had upped the dose a little bit more than he could handle, because he had to drink a lot of water to offset the buildup of sodium in his blood, and he wasn't able to drink quite enough, and he threw up one evening. So one morning after an up dose, and that was a hiccup, and resolved in a day, and they, you know, went back down a little bit in dosing, and he was just getting used to it, a balancing act of drinking enough water while the infusions were going on. And after, I guess, how many days, 7, 8, 9 days, the FDA basically went back to Brzezinski with, we want you to shut down the trial altogether. That he had received a letter earlier on saying no new enrollments. We have some questions about some issues, old issues that they're dredging up out of the past, which Brzezinski had effectively addressed and then heard nothing about afterwards, and the trial had been approved in the meantime, and then suddenly they're fishing them up and trying to shut him down. Well, we kind of snuck between the cracks because he had already started, and so after several days, they basically, you know, issued a clarification saying, no, shut it all down, you're done. And so Neil was kicked out.
So, I mean, the devastation of that, and for Neil to witness, be there, to hear that under the circumstances he was in, what a devastating thing to experience.
I mean, it was worse than the first time he got the prognosis.
Right.
Because, you know, he had found some hope, and if you don't have hope, then you don't have anything. He had found some real hope. He knew he wasn't going to be cured for sure. I mean, not even a 50-50 chance. It was like maybe about 2 in 10, maybe, that he'd have a substantially positive result. But that was enough. That was way, way, way better than anything else anybody else was telling us about. And certainly no one else had pointed us to someone like Celeste. No one else could say, yes, here's a 3-year survivor for you to go talk to. That just didn't exist to any of our doctors' knowledge. And they were skeptical about Celeste. I mean, their first thought was, well, she probably was misdiagnosed, which tends to be the way a lot of Brzezinski's successes are sloughed off, as someone was misdiagnosed. But yeah,
right.
Neil was crushed. Neil was absolutely crushed, and we were crushed right there with him.
Beyond devastated. Just beyond.
Yeah. I can't imagine. So from there, what happened? Did you, because I haven't read the end of the book,
that's the cliffhanger end of the book. I have, the next book picks up with what happens next.
Okay.
We get involved in a court scuffle with the FDA.
Right, and that's what I wanted to ask, because I remember Wendy mentioning that she went to court to stand up. And so what happened with that? See, all those, it's neat to know all the details. I find it satisfying to have all the details for some reason.
Well, actually, as far as court appearances are concerned, we were in Houston. And so we could only supply records and encouragement, but the attorney that ended up working with us, Kathleen Haggerty, a gem of a woman, just went all out, found a constitutional infringement, basically, on Neil's fundamental rights of to due process. And and based on that, the FDA backed down and the judge issued a temporary restraining order, and it continued on for a while in terms of making it a full-time exemption. But ultimately...
Was he able to go back to the infusions?
Yes, ultimately he was able to go back to his infusions.
Okay. All right. Well, let's leave that there. We have a quick break, and then when we come back, let's talk about what you have learned, and we'll go from there. We'll be back a couple minutes.
Take a journey to a place of the divine love within with Deborah Bovee on the Love by Intuition show, Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. and 6 a.m. Eastern. Our message is love in the purest form. The light within us all is a guide to recall our beginning, to learn to love self and humankind, and to feel the higher power of our own divinity. To attract love, one needs to be love. Come join us and step into this glorious vibration called love.
Delight your kids with an enchanting journey by reading the Paper Doll Kids children's book by Deborah Bovee and Janine Sullivan. There's even a catchy tune, Kids for Love Song, produced by Bob Sherwood and sung by kids just like yours. The story weaves around seven paper dolls flying around the world doing good deeds as they bring important attention to our endangered animal friends. There's even a magical ring with a universal message. Kids become interested in service projects, action through compassion, and planting seeds that nurture positive change. The Paper Doll Kids and Kids for Love Song are a production of the Kids for Love Project. Get the book now on Amazon Kindle and the song on Feedy Baby or iTunes.
Are miracles real? Can you move from mayhem to miracles? 30 prominent authors say yes as they share their high fives and down lows of challenges, abuse, addiction, and love. Experience hope, the magic elixir of miracles, through the personal stories of New York Times bestselling authors James Redfield, Dr. Bernie Siegel, Sister Jenna, Reverend Temple Hayes, and many more. If you like bestsellers, Chaos to Clarity, and Crappy to Happy, you'll love Crying and Laughing Through Mayhem to Miracles. Sacred Stories of Transformational Hope, available now on Amazon and in bookstores worldwide.
It's a child's job to play, to learn, and to have fun. It's an adult's job to keep them safe. Did you know that 1 in 4 girls and 1 in 6 boys will be sexually abused before the age of 18? Every day, families enter the Children's Advocacy Center because of child's courage to tell someone what happened to them. Keeping our children safe starts with a conversation. This is Michelle Aranger, Executive Director of the Children's Advocacy Center. Learn more on how to keep your child safe. Visit cacofbc.org. This message made possible by the Fall River Rotary Club.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.
And following up from our last sentence or so, Dean, for how much time had spanned in the event from the time that Dr. Brinsky's clinic was closed down to the time, because the court system doesn't happen overnight, to the time when Neil was back having his effusions?
Just 17 days.
Yeah, a little more than 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Can't say exactly, beyond a little more than 2 weeks.
Do you
It moved more quickly than we would have thought possible for, in that regard.
I have to
thank our attorney, Kathleen Haggerty, for just really rattling cages and getting stuff done and coming up with an argument that was kind of obvious, but she framed it in a way that the FDA couldn't squirm out of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that made a huge difference in the outcome for Neil?
I think that this. I mean, there's so many ifs. I mean, if he could have been properly diagnosed five months sooner, started the same treatment 5 months sooner, he might not have had the issues that he had with swallowing and taking in enough water to you know, be able to increase his dose more than he did. The trauma of being thrown out. I mean, stress is. As you well know, stress is a killer. He's already got a killer in him, and here's another one just jumped on his back and started pounding on him. There's no question that that had a negative impact.
Right.
There's just no knowing if absent those two impediments, would it have come out any differently? We don't know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he did outlive his prognosis substantially. He was given 6 months if they provided intervention at MGH or Dana-Farber, what they recommended, and he lived just about a year. So he did significantly better than they expected he would have done.
Absolutely. So let's talk about what you've learned, and you both can chime in together. You mentioned the medical system is designed to protect patients. So tell us what's on your mind in all that area.
Well, it seems like the medical system is designed to protect the medical system to a certain extent. I mean, we met a lot of very good-hearted, very well-meaning people, but they were definitely oftentimes constrained, possibly because of their training as much as anything. A lot of these oncologists have got no clue that, you know, encouraging their patients to eat candy to sustain their strength is actually feeding the cancer. There's you know, just because they're a doctor does not make them an expert. You gotta basically try to learn as much as you can yourself. And when you hear someone just react in a very negative, dismissive fashion regarding a treatment without offering some kind of substantial rationale and proof behind it, then you might start to say, well, maybe that they're actually doing something right, those people that the mainstream doesn't want us to talk to. And so there's sort of that facet of things. I mean, Wendy could speak forever on the nutrition, but, you know, keeping an alkalized body is supposedly very beneficial to helping thwart cancer. And the nutrition in general, the processed foods being cut out, keeping things flowing through your body, keeping plenty of fluid to help flush toxins and things like that. They play a much bigger role than anybody really seems to want to give that credit for, unless you're talking to an alternative practitioner or someone on the outside the mainstream system.
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
Wendy, do you want to talk about censorship, things of that sort?
Ooh. it's really hard. I mean, I was, got some, not so much censorship, but I got trolled, basically, and disparaged for our choice that we made. And it was very, I don't know, you wonder how much the person got paid to do it. But no, I think that really we need to be open to having conversations about both conventional medicine and holistic medicine or integrative medicine, because we need to be able to combine all of these things together. And you do get a lot of people who poo-poo whether it's nutrition, oh, that doesn't really matter, or energy medicine, or, any number of things. Gerson, oh, that doesn't work. I mean, we need to have more open conversations. And more we are hearing about personalized medicine. And with every cancer, I think every DIPG is a great case in point. The genetic profile for each person is unique, and their situation is unique. There's different root causes, factors, and so forth involved. And you can't just cure something without finding out what, addressing the cause. Was it toxins? Was it metals that got into the tissue, into the brain tissue? Some kind of poison, who knows? And then there's the whole aspect of stress and how much stress play a role in it, right? Sleep, there's just so many factors. Yeah. But I feel like we need to be more open. And when censorship just cuts people off and says, no, you're wrong, and they're not, nobody, they don't even... What really bothers me about censorship is there's no reasonable response, like anything to back it up. It's just, no, it's wrong. But they don't tell you why it's wrong. They can't give you any kind of science behind that. They just push it at you that way. And oh, there is science. Dean, you want to weigh in on that?
Well, I mean that speaks to a lot of what's been happening in the last several years to the whole population of the planet, and you know, being basically experimented on as guinea pigs, and told to try vaccines that, you know, in point of fact, never performed as they were advertised they were performed, and only after the fact, years later now, do they admit, no, they, you know, really didn't prevent people from transmitting the disease. And no, actually, some people did have some pretty nasty side effects, and actually a lot more people had nasty side effects than they're willing to admit. But, you know, that's where censorship has been abominable. You know, the idea of, I mean, this is why Neil's story is important, because it helps crack open a little bit what's going on today in terms of people being denied access to treatments and being forced into certain directions. And it's just, I don't know what more to say without launching into something that'll take a lot more time. But
Right. Well, we learned why we wrote the book.
The book is basically a chronology of the actual events as they occurred, trying not to be expository and this and that happened, but actually show it as best I could and illustrate it with the actual emails that went back and forth and what doctors told us, excerpts from reports to give a sense
which
of
was
what doctors were telling Neil. And I don't think I've ever seen any book quite like that.
Yes. I mean, it pulls you in. We only have like half a minute left. What do you hope for by speaking about your journey and all the details? What do you hope the people out there will learn?
I hope that people will read this and go, wow, I hadn't thought that, or thought about that, or I haven't thought about that. I think a lot of people, when you get a bad diagnosis and suddenly you don't know you don't have enough time, particularly with something this short, and a lot of people just say, oh, I guess the doctor will you know, tell me what to do, and I'll go with whatever the doctor says. You really have to be your own advocate. You've got to persevere. You've got to do your own research. You've got to talk to a lot of people. And you ultimately, you're the one making the decisions. It shouldn't be the doctor making the decisions. Ultimately, the patient and the patient's family are the ones that should be making the decisions.
Agreed. Well, we're going to have you back when you have your second of the trilogy. And I want to thank you for coming on, sharing your souls, and just giving in the way that you are. So thank you both. And we will stay in.
Can I mention one more thing?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. No, the website for the book is DIPGbook.com.
Yes.
And we just put in a pre-order button today.
So
to pre-order the book, they can do that. And we look forward to people. We will get those books out to people who pre-order ASAP because we want people to read it.
Mid-late June.
And give us reviews and give us feedback. Yep.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again. And everyone out there, share this show, share the books, buy the books. Everyone should have a copy. And until we come together again, au revoir.
Au revoir.
Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
There is a book reading list.
Are you seeking a clearer path to love? Then tune in to the Love by Intuition show next week, all designed to your highest good. To contact Deborah Buffet, owner of Empowered Connections, call her at 508-226-1723. That's 508-226-1723. Or link on to lovebyintuition.com. Remember, we are all one, and we are all part of the miracle of love.
This is Dream Vision 7 Radio Network, uniting mankind with universal love. Our shows are created from the heart, bringing each listener to a place of divine enlightenment. Breathe, relax, and enjoy. Let life flow.